Hello, fellow Earth folks. I'm Annie Gigg, GYG, here on CFRU 93.3 FM and CFRU.ca, available wherever you are in the world. Warm welcome to Better Me, Better World, the show for growth-minded changemakers, difference makers, and happiness makers. In the previous two episodes, I'd begun sharing my life story, and today's episode continues this story with Chapter 3 called You Sexy Thing, You. Why am I doing this, telling my story? Well, not because I'm special. Oh, wait, yes, it is because I'm special as each and every one of us 8 billion or so human folk inhabiting this planet. It's also because I'm unique, just like the one-of-a-kind you and every single person who's ever existed. It's because I have an important story to tell, just as important as yours. Important, not because of high drama, but because no one else sees the world as I do, so no one else can tell the stories I have to tell. Ditto for you, my friend. Why else? Well, it's therapeutic. It helps me process events, be in touch with the real me, understand and forgive myself and others, and wonderfully, it helps me know I'm not alone. Knowing you're not alone can be so healing and comforting. I get little jolts of that comfort, enjoying memes. I often see myself reflected in them and come to happily know there are a gazillion other people who do the same thing that I'd previously thought was behavior peculiar to peculiar, quirky me. Recently, as a silly little example, I watched a video of someone cooking up a packaged food product. He'd read the cooking instructions on the package, tossed the package in the garbage, and proceeded with the task. A moment later, he took the package out of the garbage, read the instructions again, and carried on, repeating this process of removing the package from the garbage a number of times just to make sure he was following the cooking instructions. So relatable. I'm not alone. Telling your story can give another person that healing, comforting knowledge that they're not alone on their life journey. You cannot walk anyone else's journey for them, but you sure can support them, encourage them on their way by recounting your travel experiences, whether dramatic or seemingly insignificant. What you feel is insignificant can be precisely the missing bit someone else needs to help make sense of their story. So, with that preamble on the importance of telling your story, let's continue with Chapter 3 of my story, You Sexy Thing, You. It was the typical extended family chaos happening in our house with my dad's sister's family over for a visit. Numerous noisy kids running around indoors and out, the adults sitting in the kitchen drinking, I don't know what, beer, whiskey, being boisterous in that alcohol-induced way. I was walking into the kitchen and my godfather, Uncle Joe, looked at the 8, 9, 10-year-old me, I'm not sure, possibly through alcohol-tinted lenses, and said something to the effect, "Wow, she's going to be a looker when she grows up." I don't remember his exact words, but I've never forgotten the impression they made. Here's an adult noticing me, which, if you listen to the previous episode, you'll know was huge for me, and saying something positive about me. I knew from that moment on, even though I didn't really understand what his words meant, I couldn't disappoint him. It became my destiny to become a looker. Being a looker means people look at you. They see you as attractive. This was another way for me to become visible, yet it wasn't a clear-cut way ahead by any means. As I've previously said, comparing myself to my beautiful older sister, Maureen, I didn't find myself very attractive at all. I might have been a bit pretty, but my nose was too long, my slightly wavy hair always did its own thing, my thighs were too large. In grade 9, I began wearing glasses for my nearsightedness. Lookers don't wear glasses. But backing up to elementary school, I became intent on being found attractive. I'd say more than the typical prepubescent girl, at least in my sheltered world. I had a destiny to fulfill. I tried to emulate the model Twiggy. I was envious of and perplexed by my classmate Henrietta, who was extremely pretty without even trying and didn't seem to give her appearance a second thought. In or about grade 5 or 6, probably in a pretty typical way, I started consciously looking at certain boys in a manner that begged them to notice me, validate me, confirm I was attractive. But did I have a certain look even before I consciously flirted that guys found attractive? Was that why my Uncle Joe said what he did? Is that why my 5-year older male cousin chose me to take into the shed and sexually molest when I was around 8 years old? Is that why years later, still without consciously seeking it out, I was propositioned by friends of my husband and a couple of male relatives? Well into motherhood, I was told by an older acquaintance I had a come-hither look. Another time, while sitting in a boardroom with a fellow employee, I was, inappropriately, told I had gorgeous eyes. That was rather awkward and uncomfortable. Was that look there before I even realized it? Did I then become aware of it and start to use it consciously to seek affirmation? Did that behavior become so second nature, it's why I couldn't answer my sister decades later when, after I came out about my affair, she asked how I'd even initiated an affair. Well, it just happened, was all I could say. By no means was I ever a blatant flirt. I never had the self-confidence or self-esteem for that. I never dressed provocatively, only ever wore a little titch of makeup. I was a mousy introvert, a sexy mousy introvert, I guess, because sex was part of my life from early on. It was and it wasn't. Sex was never, ever talked about in my childhood home. Mom, what's menstruation? I remember asking. She told me to go ask one of my older sisters because she was busy. I recall specifically asking Maureen as she was brushing down her horse out in the shed, but I don't recall receiving a reply from Maureen or either of my other two older sisters. Shortly after posing my question to Mom, however, as a grade sixer, I was given special permission to sit in with the grade 7 and 8 girls when a public health nurse came to the school to talk about it. That's the only time I recall interacting with Mom, as minimal as it was, about anything even remotely related to sex. I would never have dreamed of talking to her or any of my older sisters about touching myself in ways that felt good, and I'd know I'd had that experience long before I asked about the menstruation. To heap on to the guilt associated with that, I remember guiltily and furtively sketching pictures of how I thought men and women did it, making sure I finally tore up the illustrations once complete. How I framed these sins in confession, I have no exact recollection, but I'm quite sure it was in a manner that the priest could not interpret. However, to my mind, that would have been okay because God knew what I was confessing. To this day, I continue to wonder how might my prepubescent sexual molestation experience in the shed have influenced my early interest in sex. And this experience, coupled with the taboo nature of sex as I learned it, i.e. any sexual behavior outside of matrimonial coupling to produce children was a sin, well, it messed big time with my brain and my feelings. I remember thinking at some point in time that because unsanctioned sex was sinful, probably even a mortal sin, the worst offense I could ever commit against the Catholic Church was to have an affair. Did that childish thought play into the adult me manifesting that thought? For decades, I never told my story about my youthful sexual encounter in the shed. It remained a festering sore I kept shamefully hidden, foreshadowing perhaps the keeping of a greater secret later in life. Moving ahead in time, in my 40s, I volunteered as a sexual abuse speaker to grade 6 kids in public schools to raise awareness and empower the kids to take appropriate action in connection with inappropriate sexual behavior. During the extensive training for that volunteer work, I learned how important it is for victims to speak about their sexual abuse to trusted, safe listeners. Sometime thereafter, I finally spoke to certain family members about my molestation, and I experienced firsthand those benefits of telling your story that I'd mentioned earlier in this episode. It turned out I wasn't alone. Other family members had had somewhat similar experiences, albeit not involving the same molester. It was incredibly freeing to speak my truth and rewarding to create an opening for others to speak theirs. It was healing. My shame, exposed to the light, disintegrated like a vampire caught in sunlight. There remains one matter associated with this particular story that I wish I'd handled differently. Another very important thing I learned in the sexual abuse training is that statistically, my abuser, any sexual abuser, is very likely to have abused others. His siblings, I wondered, other cousins, later on, his children. As such, it's crucial not to keep your story untold, because in the telling, it could very well help someone else in dire circumstances. This learning was decades after the incident. My perpetrator was older by that time. His kids grown, his siblings moved on with their own lives. I convinced myself there was nothing to be gained by confronting him or perhaps speaking with his then wife, as surely any potential deviant sexual behavior with other minors would be a thing of his long past. In reality, it was probably just a young teenage thing on his part, I told myself. Would there have been any benefit in exposure? More than 20 years later, after the sexual abuse training, 60 years after the incident, I still, as I'm speaking this, question if I should have exposed him. Should I still? My mental, emotional wrestling continues. If there have been other victims, exposure could potentially create an opening for them to tell their healing stories, no matter how much time has passed. On the flip side, if my encounter with him was in fact a one-off, a great deal of unwarranted damage could be done within our extended family. I just had an aha as I was writing this. Another wonderful example of the power of storytelling, its ability to help clarify and move the storyteller forward. It's become clear. I don't need to continue with this wrestling. I will talk over the matter with a therapist and get professional assistance to find the best way to deal with this long, outstanding issue. Wow, this aha was not fabricated. It happened in real time while writing, because of the writing. I'm very grateful to you listeners for being there to hear my story. And this brings us to the end of chapter 3 of my story, You Sexy Thing You. The synopsis of the chapter would be this. Number one, that there was a confusing interplay between my religious upbringing and my youthful sexual activities. Two, I felt compelled to live up to my godfather's prediction that I'd be a looker, even though, try as I might, I could never see myself as particularly attractive. Number three, I sensed I had a look, not a beauty, that guys did find attractive, of which I was initially unconscious but would later consciously use to try to help satisfy my unquenchable thirst to be noticed. And four, I have an outstanding matter I'm committed to addressing. These influences from childhood and more, I know, have shaped my sexuality throughout my life. Sex is a huge part of everyone's existence in some way or another, and I encourage you to tell your sex story, how dramatic, however dramatic or seemingly insignificant, to a trusted, safe listener, and in so doing, foster greater understanding and acceptance of the holistic person who is you. It may be the end of chapter 3, but not of this episode. We're going to switch gears now to begin chapter 4, called Sorry. I couldn't say that word, sorry. I have a memory without context of Mom demanding that I say sorry to my younger brother Paul for some transgression or another. I remember it being a really painful exercise. Sorry, I blurted out with no hint of sincerity, my eyes cast down to the floor probably, although I'll never know, with a very snarly face likely. Why? Why, as I clearly recall, did I have difficulty saying sorry for so many years? I'm very sure, not infrequently, as a kid, I had ample cause to say it, being the ringleader of my pre- and early school playgroup, consisting most often of my two kid brothers, Paul and Sean, but also later on of my even younger sister, Buggy. As the oldest in the group, I did have a certain responsibility for their well-being, and I most usually and appropriately was the target of blame by Mom for our antics. I clearly recall one summer adventure where an apology to Mom would have been in line, but I had no recollection of actually offering it up. It was one of those long summer days, crying to be filled with little kid adventure. With Mom's permission, I loaded Buggy, somewhere between the age of 1 and 2, into the old-time baby buggy, and pushing Buggy in the buggy, with Paul and Sean traipsing along, headed off down the farmer's lane, which was sometimes dusty, sometimes mucky, sometimes buried beneath feet of drifted snow. The lane extended due west from our house, through fields of grain, ultimately ending at the trees that fringed the shore of Lake Huron. I'm guessing I'd made peanut butter and jam sandwiches, as I was apt to do for our adventures, expecting not to be back by lunchtime. At the age we were at, we weren't allowed to go any farther than the gate on the lane, which, for as long as I can remember, never consisted of a gate. It was just a gap in the remnants of a tumbled-down fence that once separated the front fields from the back fields, and beside which there was a thorn tree, under which we'd eat our lunch. It was about a mile walk back to the gate from our house. The day was hot, and as luck would have it, recent rains left an amazingly large, wonderfully enticing mud puddle right at the gate, almost a pond. Well, kids and mud puddles just belong together. I assured the kids it would be perfectly fine to enjoy the cool, oozy, mucky goodness of the puddles, even though I myself wasn't inclined to do so. And it would be fine, of course, for them to take off all their clothes. At some point, I guess, when the fun ran its course and our P&J sandwiches were gone, it was time to head back home. Shouldn't Mom have been grateful that I'd taken Buggy off her hands and the boys and I out of her hair for a few hours? Somehow she wasn't. When the boys shared the details of our adventure, it became a crime and I was guilty. What was the difference if they were naked? There was no one to see. So what if, despite the care taken to keep their clothes clean, they ended up as muddy as the kids? That's what washing machines are for. The tongue-lashing certainly took some of the happy out of that day, but I never did apologize. And dare I confess to another greater crime that got me much more than a tongue-lashing? Why not? Although still to this day, I can't believe I did it. Probably still in the age range of 6 or 7, with Brother Paul being 4 or 5, we'd ended up in the bathroom one day philosophizing about toilet water. Dogs drink it? Can people? I asked. Surely when the toilet's flush, there'd be no harm in it. I put the dare to Paul to test it out and got him to promise to never ever tell anyone about the dare. I obviously knew what I was doing was definitely not right. He promised, but didn't take me up on the dare, thank heavens in hindsight, and soon after we went our separate ways. A short time later, I was called into the kitchen to be asked by Mom if what Paul had told her was true. That betrayer! What a horrible, untrustworthy brother! I couldn't lie, that'd be a sin. This time, the confessed crime was too big for Mom to dole out punishment, and Dad was called upon. I'm pretty sure I was the only one of the daughters in the family to ever get a bum spanking from Dad. With tears streaming down my face, I recall not feeling sorry at all for the dare, but feeling ferociously angry at Paul for breaking his promise. Why was saying sorry such a challenge for me? Well into my teenage years and beyond, even on occasions when I knew an apology was definitely warranted. One such occasion happened about 10 years after my kid crimes. I was out for the evening touring about the gravel side roads in the township with my group of teenage friends, enjoying some beers, gravel running as it was called, freaking incomprehensible in this day and age. But anyway, I was sitting in the middle of the front bench seat of the car my boyfriend was driving. For some reason that's totally unfathomable in hindsight, while we were traveling at a good clip, I deliberately shifted the gear stick to, what, neutral, first gear, reverse, I don't remember which. Had I had too many beers and thought it would be funny to see what happened? It obviously wasn't funny in the slightest. My boyfriend screamed at me. Of course he screamed at me in front of our friends, questioning why I do such a stupid thing that could be dangerous and also seriously damage the car. I remember whimpering, I don't know. I don't remember ever saying, I'm sorry, at the time or later on after we'd made up. Saying sorry, I now understand, was so difficult because for a long, long time, I equated it to saying, I'm sorry I'm a screw-up. I'm sorry I'm a bad person. I'm sorry I exist. Over many years, it never occurred to me that I'm sorry could mean I'm sorry that I, a good person, made a bad decision. Saying I'm sorry from a place of self-assurance and self-confidence and self-esteem and self-love is admitting to wrongdoing, not wrong being. But when those selfies are lacking, admitting to failure or bad decision-making further erodes any self-esteem and self-love that may already be struggling to exist. When in that vulnerable place, saying I'm sorry is an admission that makes you even more vulnerable to blame and judgment. It reinforces your opinion of yourself that you're not really a good person. Eventually becoming able to say, I'm sorry, knowing that the apology is not an admission of me being a fundamentally flawed person, but rather an admission of a beautifully flawsome person who did or said something deserving of apology, was hugely liberating. It feels so damn good to be able to appropriately apologize and not feel like I'm undermining my worth. Getting to that place of liberation took decades of personal development work, and it remains a work in progress with rewards all along the way. When I got far enough along in fostering my self-love so that I was no longer terrified, or at least less terrified, of being vulnerable, I became able to admit to and apologize for a very big wrong I'd committed against a lot of people I love. A wrong I'd kept hidden for a long time, or more correctly, a wrong that kept the real me hidden for a long time. I've spoken of it before. My affair that led to my firstborn being fathered by someone other than who she thought of as her dad for more than 20 years. There was no way the shameful, disgusting, fraudulent, deceitful, unself-loving person I was for many years could say, I'm sorry, because that apology would have confirmed all those horrible aspects of me. It would be admitting to others what I knew about myself. It would absolutely ensure nobody could like the me I couldn't like. When I came to like and love my fallible, flawsome, genuine, self-respecting self, I became enabled to say, I'm sorry, to the people my course of action impacted. That coming out, that act of vulnerability, it didn't demean me. It didn't make me think of myself as weak. It enabled me to show up in my world as my real self, who admittedly made some really unhealthy decisions that hurt others. If someone can't like me for my faults, that is their choice. They choose to hate the sinner as well as the sin, but it doesn't impact the love I have for my only true human self. This self-loving me has come a long way from the days of insincerely and painfully spitting out an I'm sorry in the general direction of my kid brother. To be effective, an apology must first and foremost be sincere. Harvard Medical School posted an article called The Power of Apologies, which describes the components of an effective apology. As per the following extract from the article, an effective apology must include, number one, a specific definition of the perceived offense. The person offended and the perceived offender need a clear shared understanding of the behaviors or omissions that felt hurtful, rude, or wrong. Number two, acknowledging that the perceived offense caused harm. The person offended needs recognition that their pain or embarrassment was legitimate, even if others might have felt differently. Number three, taking responsibility. Offenders should acknowledge that, whether or not the offense was intentional, they were accountable for causing harm. Number four, recognition of wrongdoing. Offenders need to agree that they were insensitive and made a mistake. Number five, a statement of regret. Well, I'm sorry is generally not enough for a complete apology. It is a necessary part of any apology, and it's imperative for rebuilding trust. Number 6, a promise not to repeat the offense. The offender needs to offer a clear plan for self-restraint, improved behavior, and how to work with the offended person to address possible future misunderstandings. And finally, number 7, an explanation of why the offender acted this way. But be careful. An explanation can be risky as it can sound defensive or seem to be an excuse for bad behavior. Sometimes it is useful for healing a broken relationship and may set the groundwork for reestablishing trust and respect. An explanation is only effective if combined with all the other above elements. End of the article extract. And almost end of our time together. I just about made it through without sharing quotes about saying sorry, but I do have time to squeeze in a couple. This first one actually is one I've never been able to agree with. It's from the Eric Segal novel, Love Story, popularized by the 1970 movie adaptation starring Ally McGraw and Ryan O'Neill, which I saw as an impressionable 15-year-old. The quote that is the motto of the story is, "Love means never having to say you're sorry." I say love of self and others means being able to say you're sorry. Even with empowering self-love, saying sorry most often isn't easy. Elton John sings, "What do I say when it's all over?" And sorry seems to be the hardest word. I say, whether it's all over or just beginning or somewhere in between, say the hardest word whenever it's due. Say sorry. And I'm sorry to say that's a wrap for today. I invite you to tune in to the next episode of Better Me, Better World as the storytelling continues. I'll be back same time next week, same place here at CFRU 93.3 FM or CFRU.ca. The shows are recorded, so alternatively, have a listen when it works best for you. Until next time, be you. I'm Annie Gigg.